I am not a good cook, to put it lightly. I burn eggs, I serve undercooked raw French toast, I steam broccoli until it sags. I set off smoke detectors and I ruin pans. I've melted the edges of both of our plastic spatulas until they curl under like seas. But I know that healthy eating is important. I know if I eat at taco time, I won't have any energy. But I just don't get cooking. I don't understand why beets are better roasted than they are boiled. I don't understand why butter makes everything so delicious. Cooking is a world I don't understand. It feels like uncharted territory. It feels like a different language. A wise friend who is also an excellent cook told me once, just follow the recipe. Well, duh, I know that. But when I follow a recipe, I don't want to measure out a fourth of a teaspoon of something. That's practically nothing, so I just throw a dash in. And I can't find the cayenne pepper. Maybe we're out of it, so I put chili powder in because that has cayenne pepper in it. It's more or less the same. But she says, no, you have to really follow the recipe, step by step, perfectly and exact. And in this unknown world of cooking, the directions may save the recipe. There's another unknown world we've been cast into over the past few weeks. Another strange place where it feels really easy to misstep. We are suddenly aware of a world in which skin color has a lot more to do with whether you're protected by the police or abused. It turns out there are two worlds, much more different than I ever realized, a world of white skin and a world of dark skin. And the worlds are really different. Maybe you've heard hints about this world. I know I have. Snippets from friends who are people of color, or my friend who always is stopped at airport security, no matter where we're going. But for most of us, this is the first time race inequality has been pushed to the forefront of our Facebook feeds. Or at least our conversations. Has anybody seen the hashtag criming while white? It's pretty, I don't know what to say about it. It's funny in a sad way. It was started by Jason Ross, who's a writer on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. And thousands of white people are tweeting about blatant criminal acts that they've done that the police have either ignored or just asked them to stop politely. College kids blew pot smoke into an officer's face when they were pulled over while driving erratically, and the officer told them to knock it off. Shoplifters were asked to please return to the store and pay for their merchandise, or at least return the merchandise, after they had walked out with it. Teens were playing with air guns in a big box store, shooting them at each other, running all over the place and rolling on the ground, and the police said, please stop. In contrast to this is the Living Well Black hashtag. Has anybody seen that one? It's a riff on the phrase, driving while black. Well, people say, why were you pulled over? I was driving while black. On that one, people share their experiences with police abuse while living their day-to-day lives. One law student said that every time she enters the university library, she gets a warning talk from a police officer about stealing. Another woman was pulled over late at night and accused of being a prostitute. She was just driving. A third reported that she had been mugged, and the police asked if she was making it up to cover a gambling debt or an addiction problem. A man was pulled over after dropping off a white friend in an affluent neighborhood, and the cops cracked his taillight with their flashlights and told him never to come back to their town. But he wasn't even speeding. This is a new world for most of us white folks, a world we feared might exist, but we're happy to not really have to acknowledge, until the death of Mike Brown in Ferguson. A world that is terrifyingly bleak, with an African-American child shot and killed in Cleveland, a father in New York, and every few days a new report about police brutality, even here in Seattle, about the dangers of living while black. How do we, as big-hearted, well-meaning, not racist folks, make sense of this new universe, which has existed just under our noses? We need a recipe. Just like I need a recipe to make anything more complicated than tea, we need instructions for figuring out how to stand with our African American brothers and sisters. We need a recipe because the scariest thing about talking about race for white folks is that we fear we might say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, and reveal ourselves to be somehow deeply bigoted when we had no idea. What if we open our mouths to express solidarity in what comes out as a garbled message that sounds like we should be in the Klan? We need a plan. So a plan for us well-meaning white folks is what I have tried to concoct today. First, we need to let our hearts break. You have to break eggs to make an omelet, and you have to break your own heart to be an ally. It is so tempting to intellectualize these murders of black people. It's so tempting because it gives us some space. If we get into the nitty-gritty of crime statistics, if we compare geographic regions in terms of police brutality, oh, it's so much worse in the South, we Northerners love to say. If we say, well, the officer's father was killed by an African-American man, so clearly it was deep in his psyche. We're protecting our heart from feeling these tragedies. We're reading article after article and report after report in the New York Times and on Slate and in The Stranger, so we don't have to feel the pain that is the tragedy of a life cut short due to someone commissioned to protect and serve failing to do either. We can argue about whether this is a class or a race issue. I think it's both. We can argue about that until the cows come home, but what will actually help this process is to just let your heart break. As my colleague, the minister Victoria Weinstein, said, put down the newspaper and the laptop. There are caskets going by. And just in the past few weeks, the caskets have held Michael Brown, ready to start college. He wasn't perfect. Do black people have to be saints to deserve to live? Is stealing cigars a death penalty offense? Michael Brown wasn't perfect, but he loved animals, especially his dog. He was nuts about his grandmother, and he loved his mom and his stepfather. He loved having dinner on the weekends with them. And then he was shot and left on the street for 4.5 hours on the cold winter pavement. And his family came, and they wailed around him, but they couldn't move his body because it was a crime scene. We have 18-year-olds in this church family. We have 18-year-olds that we love, who are so excited to see what they do next with their incredible young lives. They're so full of potential and love and energy. They mean so much to us. Can we imagine the pain that Mike Brown's church family is in? And his mom and his stepdad and his grandmother. Just for a second, can we just feel it? So Tamir Rice was sitting on the swings in my old neighborhood, Cleveland, Ohio. He was on the playground, and he had a toy gun in his pocket. It was on a Saturday, and there was snow on the ground. And he was shot twice in the chest. The officer drove right up on the lawn next to the swings and shot him before saying anything. He was shot, and the officers didn't try to revive him. Even though he was laying on the ground, he wasn't dead. He was conscious. He didn't die till the next day. So he was 12, laying in the snow and watching the adults freak out about how they were going to protect themselves, freak out about whether the union would be able to take care of them. His middle school teacher said at his memorial that Tamir had perfect attendance and he loved to sing. He loved to sit at his desk and just sing and sing and sing. And he was always trying to get other kids to sing with him. And she'd have to say, okay, Tamir, singing is wonderful, but in its place, we have to do some work now. We have 12-year-olds in our church family, kids that we love, kids at that threshold of being a teenager where they go back and forth all the time from moody teenager to sweet kid, kids that we cherish. Can we feel Tamir's family's pain? Can we let it in? Oh, it's so hard, isn't it? It's like getting kicked in the chest. It hurts. Just a kiddo on the swings. Snowy Saturday. Well, third, but not last, unfortunately, but third for our purposes this morning, we have the death of Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father who was selling loose cigarettes, which is a crime, but not a death penalty crime. He was choked to death by one police officer while two others held his body down to the ground. We've had a lot of talk about that officer, but two other people stood there and held him down. He repeatedly yelled, "I can't breathe," while being strangled. It's a hard video to watch. I don't recommend it, frankly. Up to you. Eric was known as the Big E in his mostly white neighborhood where he knew everybody. We have 43-year-olds in this church family. We love them. Can we feel the pain that Eric Gardner's widow has really beautifully and eloquently expressed? Can we feel the heartache of his children who stood at the window and watched people walk by, march by in their father's honor, who were proud but more sad that they wouldn't see him again? Let's try to put aside the intellectualizing and realize there are three families that this morning woke up and had to remember again that they're never going to see this person again. Let your heart break. It's the most vital and important and awful step in the recipe. It's hard not to intellectualize. It's hard not to say, well, if his hands had gone up sooner or things are better than they used to be. Our theme this month is adversity, which is an apt one for a month that includes Hanukkah, the darkness of winter solstice, and Christmas. Christmas, the celebration of the birth of Jesus, the ancient advocate for those oppressed by society, the man who opted to sit beside folks on the margins of society rather than the high priests and the rulers. And sitting beside is the next instruction in our recipe. Sit beside and listen. Yesterday, I participated in a large march. It was absolutely unbelievable. It was down at Garfield High School, and it was put on by the Black Student Union, which is like, I don't know, 15 high school kids. And they put on this march, and like 700 people came. It was unbelievable. It was so organized. It was just it was a beautiful experience. And they were just so well-spoken and just incredibly eloquent people, and their kids. And it was a protest, and it was a wake for these three people that we just talked about. It was my third protest and wake in the past few weeks, and I noticed again how eager white people were to tell their story, to try to take charge and lead. And I think that comes from a really good intention. I do. I think it comes from the best possible place, an eagerness to help or a chance to try to repent. White people were vying for the microphones. But these Black Student Union kids were amazing, and they just said, you know, why don't you let Black people talk about their pain? We get that you get it. Like, we get that you're here to feel it and empathize, but, you know, this is primarily their story. This is their story of abuse because of skin color. We white folks have a lot of things to think through. We have to think about where we've been complicit. We have to think about where we've been so privileged we didn't have to notice that this was all happening. We have stories to tell. We have plenty of pain to work through, but we need to do it with other white people. It's not Black people's job to help us negotiate our grief. Those vital conversations have to happen with other white folks. So sitting with these deaths, feeling this pain, these weeks I've wondered, what can I do? What can one person do in the face of all this injustice? I hear these cries from my colleagues, my fellow ministers, DREs, and also my friends. What can we do? What must we do? And perhaps the biggest relief of this second civil rights movement, as it's now being called, is that the infrastructure is there. People have been doing this work for years. We don't have to reinvent the wheel or start new organizations. Black folks have been agitating for decades. We just didn't notice. We just need to add our voice to theirs. If you want to be an ally, you can join the NAACP, the ACLU. You can go to a teach-in or a sit-in or a protest. You can join the Coalition to Stop Police Brutality on Facebook, which is where I keep hearing about these protests. You can talk to other white people about race. It is such an awkward thing to talk about. But the friends that I've brought race up with have expressed relief. It's sort of having this thing said, this elephant in the room. Let's just talk about it. Have an honest and emotional conversation about white privilege with other white folks. The third step is maybe the most fun step. We're going to remember our mentors. So this is the one-year memorial of the death of Nelson Mandela, which is why our choir has been singing such fantastic South African music today. This great man spent his whole life agitating to end racial apartheid in South Africa. Mandela said, "To be free is not just to cast off your own chains, but to live in a way that enhances and respects the freedom of other people." Each of us can recount a time we had to cast off our own chains. Now, invigorated by the memory of those greats who preceded us on this journey, we can move forward. Remember your heroes and feel their strength course through you. The fourth step in our recipe is recall how far we've come. Things are pretty bad in the U.S. for people of color right now, today, 2014, but we're making progress. Comedian Chris Rock, who is a black man and hilarious, has been speaking on race relations a lot over the past few weeks, which takes incredible strength of character for him, I'm sure. And he mentioned that his mother, growing up in Andrews, South Carolina, had to go to the vet to get her teeth pulled because no dentist would see black people. And people of color had to go to the back door of the vet clinic because if white people knew that he was using his instruments on black people, they wouldn't bring their dogs to that vet. Ouch. I mean, oh, God, it makes me nauseous. However, Chris Rock says, hey, we white folks are making progress. We're finally realizing how crazy wrong that is. And that's something to celebrate. It doesn't mean we can stop. It doesn't mean we don't have to push forward. But we're getting somewhere. All this work is leading to something. This is it, folks. I can see the promised land from where I'm standing. I really think this could happen in my lifetime. We have come so far. There are only a few steps left. These final steps might be the hardest. I may never be able to cook broccoli, but this recipe, this chance, is a chance to feed our hungry souls. Because racism hurts everyone. It hurts black people probably a lot more, but it hurts us too. It hurts a lot. Because it's a break in our chance to be in fellowship with each other. Together, side by side, led by our broken hearts, listening to our allies, remembering our mentors, recalling how far we've come, we can create a world where it is not a crime to be black.